This is the Authentic Persuasion Show. Hey everybody, Jason here again. Welcome to part two of my conversation with the amazing Greg Zippy. So Greg is here. Greg, are you ready to talk about persuasion and that piece of the sales process?
Love that piece of the sales process. We can do that.
And for people tuning in, we had a conversation. Part one was all about authenticity, where so much of it blends. Greg and I were talking in between episodes here where it's like, could just have continued the conversation because so much of the authenticity piece blends into the sales process. If you didn't check it out, make sure to check out part one. You can find the video. You can find the podcast, a little bit of his background in case you're finding this and you want to go visit that one later. Stay here and then you can go check it out. But Greg comes to the world of teaching at BYU in their selling program, their sales program, after 33 years of selling enterprise, mostly enterprise focused at companies like Oracle and Adobe Systems. He retired in 2019 and said, hey, what can I do? I know, I'll go help the future of sales. Like he told his background story in the first part of his looking at the gap that was missing from the students that were coming out of schools in his area and thought, hey, what can I do to help? And then here we are. And so let's jump into this part two on persuasion. One of the biggest things you said in the first part was they want value, right? They want you to bring value to them. They want you, you don't need to necessarily teach them things. I mean, you kind of do, but people have the education piece, but they want that before they all trust you. How do you build that sales process? What does that process look like specifically, you know, in comparing that to the pre-internet 30 some odd years ago mode?
I think one of the biggest things is that pre-internet, we did a lot of just straight into the questioning, you know, tell me about this, tell me about that. Now, some of it is we had to. There's things we can find out on the internet now beforehand. And in fact, if we go in and ask those questions, I think that's a sin because your time is limited. And you need to find those things out ahead of time. But then when you come in, the thing that we've started doing now, I call it a little bit of putting hypotheses out there. And again, there's a lot of research around that, but it's, you know, a statement like, you know, other organizations like yours that we're working with are seeing this. Is that what you're seeing? Instead of just, what are you seeing? You know, and it guides the conversation a little more. And oftentimes it gives you a chance to get them to think about things a little bit differently. And that's, again, where the persuasion and the authenticity come back in is because, and you're showing expertise at the same time, right? You're not coming in blind. You're saying, we know what's going on in the market. Is that what's happening with you, or is your situation a little bit different? Now, even when they think their situation's different, it's really not, but you have to kind of finesse your way through it.
Well, and I think one of the ways that I see it done that I don't enjoy, and what I see as, I'm going to just say wrong, or like not, maybe not the best approach, is where people come in and say, here's what I'm seeing at other companies. I'm sure you have this problem too. Or here's what we're seeing and we're here to fix that for you as well, right? Just making that assumptive. I love how you said it's like this hypothesis of here's what we're seeing. Does that apply to you? If so, I might have a way to help you versus I have the solution. Everybody wants it. You should be begging me for it.
Yeah. You hit a couple of my hot buttons there. One is, I hate it when somebody says problem when we're selling. We talk about it in the training all the time, and it is a problem that we're trying to find, but we have to be careful not to use it when we're talking to someone, because it's like, tell me what your problems are. Oh, great. Let's get going. We're off to a good start, you know, or let me come in and fix your problem in the example that you just gave. That is the worst possible way to do it. It just takes two questions instead of one. You know, you don't need the assumptive close in there. You've got a problem. We know you do. Yeah. But it's, you know, use a word like challenge, or are there opportunities you're not getting a chance to take advantage of? Just little subtleties like that even make all the difference in the world.
Well, and it's funny too, because as soon as you started saying that, it took me back to my first real job. This is air quotes, but it's my first real job. I was in Seattle and got a job at Microsoft doing tech support. So this is the year 2000. It's when tech support and call centers were still in the US. In fact, we lost our jobs years later for the first offshoring. But one of the things we were taught in training, we weren't taught very much as far as like dealing with people. We were taught like the technical, how to solve problems. But one of the things they said is don't ever say the word problem, right? Yeah. Oh, thank you for calling Microsoft. What's your problem, right? Like then just triggers people and just starts this like battle of you versus them and makes people feel bad. And it was like, what's the issue? What's the challenge, right? So it's funny because that's so true. Just like in sales, most people who've done it long enough know, you know, don't sign the contract, right? Like fill out this form or you know, complete this. It's like these things you stay away, but salespeople love to focus on the problems and the negatives and do that. So you said there was two hot buttons. Is there a second one in there?
Whatever it was, I think I hit both of them. It was maybe simply don't use problem or say fix it for you, that kind of a thing.
So how do you then with the people that you're working with, how do you build that for them? What does that total process look like that you're training salespeople on in the students?
Yeah. So, you know, this is where it becomes one of the areas that I hit hard is trying to sell the way people naturally buy. And one of the class sessions, I hate to call them lectures because we're pretty interactive when we do them, but I'll put up there kind of the, you know, suspect, prospect, qualified, demo, gave them a proposal, you know, that chart that we have as salespeople that describes the sales process. And I said, that's how we look at it. Let me show you how a buyer's doing it. Do I have a problem? Is it worth solving? Is there a possible solution out there? Where does it fit on my priority list? Those kinds of things. And we go through what's the buyer's journey going to be as they're going through it. They don't care about, you know, we sent them a proposal. Who cares? You know, so we talk about what the buyer's journey is going to be and then try to figure out where they are in their journey and then address that particular spot. Because that's another thing. I think we lose a lot of opportunities today because we try and fully qualify using something like Bant or one of the others. And there's a lot of really good prospects that maybe don't have all four letters yet. And it's because they're at the wrong stage of the buyer's journey. And they're still, in fact, in some ways, I would argue it's better if you can get them before they have all four. Because then you can help formulate that as they go through their journey and you can give them ideas to think about. And of course, if you're presenting them out there and you're doing it in an ethical fashion, it's getting them to a good spot, but it then belongs to them instead of to us.
Fascinating regarding Bant, because I have some experience with that through consulting and you know some of my clients who have used that framework. For people who aren't familiar, it's budget, authority, need, and timing. It's fascinating you say is like get to somebody before they have all four because most people shoot that as a target. I'm guessing like if somebody has all four, they know what they want. They know what they need. They have the authority. They have the time and they have the budget. Now they're shopping and they see everything as a commodity, right? It's no longer about you have value. It's about them just ordering the solution and they just see you as like just an order taker and or a commodity.
Well, right? Or it can even be worse than that. If they get to you and they have, if they've fully formulated what their vision of a solution is going to be like, it may not match you exactly. Even if it does match you exactly, they built that. Now, you have one outside chance in the internet world that they built it off of your website. And if they did, then they built it off of your offering. But if they didn't, they built it by interacting with someone else's website or worse, someone else's salesperson. Well, if then we come in with an equal solution, who are they going to buy from? It's not us that they trust. It's the person that helped form their vision of what it is that they need to solve this particular issue. So I argue that when you come in and you have full Bant, you've got what you actually got to do is get one of your key differentiators to get added to it. So that's where you'd start saying things like, that's really interesting. And those are all good things. Have you considered? And you've got to know your positioning versus your competition to now bring in something into that vision that you do better than anyone else, or you're going to have trouble closing that deal. Now, occasionally they come in and they've just done it by, in today's world, going all over the internet, looking at everything they can find, and they really don't have a leaning. So you can still close those sometimes, but you're just not in as good a situation as if you help formulate at least part of that, especially like if you've got somebody with authority, or which is great. You don't even have to have somebody with authority though. The challenger guys, they talk about mobilizers. These are people who can get deals done. And there's just a group of people in any organization that they just have the juice to do it. If you're working with a mobilizer, I don't care if I have any of the other three.
They'll get it done.
Because we can get there. They know how to get it done if I give them a good enough reason to do it.
Funny thinking about it, because in organizations, I've always worked closely with the CEO, and I would say I'm that mobilizer, right? If there's something I want to get done, I will figure out a way to make it valuable to the organization if it's going to be, right? Yeah. Even if I don't have the full, all the others. So one of the things that you mentioned, I want to go back to, because this was super impactful. I never thought of it from this way. This is what I told you before we even started recording, how much I love these conversations, because they just, they help me see things from other perspectives, which I think is so fun, is that we salespeople, sales organizations, see it from their side. And this process, right, from, like you said, suspect to prospect to this, to that, you know, MQL, SQL, like all of these phrases in this pipeline. And then there's the other side, which is how do they see it, right? It's why I focus on the sales experience, because what is their experience going through it? It's not even the customer journey or whatever. It's the buying journey, but it's from their side, because that's all they care about. It's interesting, because how much of that from a sales organization is just because people use technology or even spreadsheets, have to put columns for statuses, have to give updates to managers, or have to organize their lead list and their pipeline. And they only have so many categories, so they just try to shove everyone in those boxes.
Mm-hmm. I think it is. And I think we get ourselves in trouble, because here's the part that drives me the craziest about that. What's the first one that's always there for everybody? Suspect. And suspect is not a positive term in selling.
No. You know, I hate that one.
Suspect. And yet, when you map it to what the buyer is going through, suspect maps to all the most important parts of the process. It's while they're trying to figure out, do I really want to work on this? Where does it fit in my priority list? Are there vendors out there that can even deliver something like this? Is this a problem that's worth solving? All of those, we call them a suspect when we find somebody that's doing any of those things. They're only a prospect when they're looking for a vendor, you know, and that's really late. And so I find the whole thing really fascinating that we start with suspect. And I look at things like, we always put it in there. We'll say delivered a proposal or gave them a quote. Well, that doesn't tell me. I can give anybody a quote. I could walk up to a guy on the street and give him a quote, you know, and yet we have it in our sales process like it's some really big thing. It doesn't tell me that I'm progressing.
And it's so true, right? Because so many salespeople think, oh, I hit that milestone, so this is going well. And then as a manager or leader, you're like, okay, but what does that mean? Like, when are you following up? Is that all these questions? And you find out, like, it just checked a box, but that box means not, like, you can't, you're not going to take that to the bank in any way.
No, I mean, the thing I'm looking for at that stage is, are they asking me questions proactively about how do we bring this into our organization? You know, that's not on our sales checklist as far as the stages of the selling cycle. Yet to me, that's one of the best buy signs later in the process that I'm doing well. Or we have in there, you know, access to the decision maker. What I've found over the years is I may get that access early, I may get it late. All I need to know is that I've got an individual that is capable and willing of giving me that access when it's appropriate in their organization's timeframe. And all organizations are different. I give you one more quick example on that. And this one is now outdated because we don't sell in person anymore. I mean, everything's becoming virtual. When I left in 2019, I left day-to-day selling. We were still fighting to get on sites for these larger deals. And we would still get them. I talked to one of my top reps just about a week ago, and I said, how often are you going on site? He said, since COVID, not at all. It's all virtual. And he said, and the reason why is because we can't get all the people in one place. And so it doesn't matter. They say, well, you can come visit me, but then we got to do a Zoom with everybody else.
But you were talking about where the stages, and this drives me crazy too, where salespeople go for the decision maker access as early as possible because that's what they're taught and they think that's all that matters.
Oh, right? That's it. And so when we used to go on site, we would find out who else is going to, and we used to like to use words like who besides you, another really good one, instead of just, well, who's the final decision maker? Because you're just undercutting the person you're talking to. Right. So who besides you? And then whoever's the highest level person that they mentioned, and this I teach my students, but we got to figure out how to do this virtually now, is I'd say, can I just shake their hand before I leave today? Mm. And it was better if I got to, but if they said, yes, let's go look for them when we're done, that was good enough for me.
100%. They're bought in.
Because you know you're working with someone that's got a relationship with that decision maker. They're not afraid of them. They know that they're meeting with you. All those things that it tells you. And then if I can shake their hand before I leave, so much the better. But it was such a great test about where the decision maker fit in. And I didn't need to meet them until the organization was comfortable that they wanted to do that.
Yeah.
Which is very
different in our processes. That is an interesting test though. And you know, how can you relate that into the virtual world? Because that is so valuable, right? If that person's willing to go find them, and that means they have a relationship, they have access, and they also see you as valuable enough to introduce, right? Like sales is relationships, right? So if I've got someone, you know, let's say it's like a dating thing and you want to introduce your parents, like at some point, like, is it valuable enough where you're willing to do that? Or is it like, not there yet? Cause I don't know either. You know, and I think that plays with it. And again, I think the part that's so valuable from what you're saying is that so many people in sales are being taught very, very incorrectly that get to the decision maker as fine as quick as possible, get to that person. That's all you need. Like, especially this band, right? Like I need authority. I got to get to that person. It's like, no. Like there's so many people in organizations that will make the decision or be able to go to that authority figure when the time is right and just get it done. And that one size fits all approach, like you said, every organization is different. That's what screws up so many sales teams, is that they think everyone's going to follow this model, like you were saying, with suspect to close deal as the only way. And it just doesn't work that way. So final question for this part on sales processes. Why do you think people don't buy in this day and age? What is it that salespeople are missing when somebody doesn't buy?
I think it's because we skip steps. I because there are still sales reps that even in a difficult environment like this are selling, but they're the ones who can sell in any environment because they don't get sloppy when times are good. And so they're doing things like making sure when they start the sales process, they're saying, here's your current situation. What do you think this is costing you right now? Do it this way. And that's where you can use hypothesis if you want. You know, other organizations we've worked with, this seems to be costing them $500,000 a year. Is that about what you think it's costing you? And actually the best answer there is when they say, no, it's not $500,000. And I don't care if it's higher or lower, but now I got them, you know, because they're really thinking about it. So we skip that step where we really fully develop the pain into, we stay too high level on pain too often. And it's got to be tangible. You know, we'll say, well, it's not user-friendly. I don't know what that means. Tell me why it's not user-friendly. Let's get a little deeper. So that's just one example, but it's in all the steps is that they don't involve the buyer. They don't get the buyer to visualize themselves that this can, using the product, that it's easy to use. They don't connect the dots very well. We always expect that if we say A and then B, that they'll understand. Well, it's obvious that equals this. Well, it isn't obvious. And when I see reps flailing in today's world, that is the main reason. Now, you're still not going to close every deal, but it can be the difference between being in let's go with today's world, being 80% and 110% of your quota, which quite honestly, I never like to look at those kind of numbers at all. It's the difference between being 110 and 150. But I'm suggesting, you know, okay, let's say it's a hard market. If you're finding yourself having trouble getting to your previous number, whatever it is, revisit your process. I will almost always say there are steps being skipped.
I love it. That's amazing. And I have one more question because that brought up something. Because also part of the process and part of the authentic persuasion piece is persuasion versus manipulation and where that line is. And obviously there's the students in your class that are thinking transactional, thinking manipulation, thinking sales is dirty and gross. And then you're teaching them about that. Where does that line fit in? You brought up pain, which is why I'm bringing this up, where I call it the Sandler pain submarine, where it's literally all focused on pain and people that only drive to pain and go deep and make that the only factor. Where is that limit there? Like you said, you want to go under the surface of the pain, right? Oh, this doesn't work well. Okay, what does that mean? And then where do you stop that where it doesn't start getting into manipulation of like pain and fear mongering?
Yeah, I think there's that's really good because I remember early in my career, I had a guy say, they got to come in with a hangnail and you got to have them leave feeling like their arm is hanging from their shoulder, you know?
Right.
That's too far. That's too far. So there's a couple of things there with the idea of manipulation, because I worry about it and my students will ask about it and I need to be prepared with that. And I think that there's two parts to that answer. Let me go to the specific. You create the pain, but then you want to paint a vision of what it can look like. You want to give them hope following that. And so if we were able to do that, or as we're able to do this, this is what's going to happen. How would that impact your organization? So you get them talking about that. You don't want to dwell on the pain. So that's part process wise. Now, ethics wise, and that's what we're talking about when you start talking about, are we influencing and teaching versus manipulating? And I think it has to do with the motives of the salesperson. Are we really creating something where we genuinely believe inside ourselves that it is for them. It is the best thing for them and that it is their decision. We don't even try and manipulate them into a decision, because some people will say, well, if it's the right decision and we knew that, doesn't matter how we get there. No, it does. It does. We've got to treat people with dignity that way. And so as long as we keep our motives about them and letting them be able to weigh all the situation and all the pieces, and then they come to the conclusion that's right for them, we're not manipulating. We're making their lives better. If we don't believe we're making their lives better, then we ought not to be representing that product. And if we can't do it at all, we ought not to be selling, quite honestly.
I love it. Perfect place to end. I couldn't agree more. I think that's great. Greg, thank you for being on the show. For people who want to tune in to more of what you're doing, follow you online or connect with you, I know they can find you on LinkedIn, Greg Zippy, Zippi. Search for that there. It's going to be in the show notes, as well as your Professional Selling Academy will be in the show notes. And then the BYU sales program will be in the show notes. Greg, thank you for this journey here talking about persuasion. Next up is the future of sales.
Sounds good. Loved this one. Look forward to the next one.
It's going to be great. I can't wait. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. I do appreciate this. We covered so much. Even just that last nugget there, looking at the ethics of sales and wanting to make lives better, right? Like I say it all the time, and I learned this from the Cub Scouts, is leave people better than you found them, like you would leave a campsite better than you found them. If you make that your goal, it's going to shift sales from this dirty word into something that people actually want to seek out, because they actually want the help, because they know it will leave them better than you found them. So make sure you do that, and make sure to catch part three. We're going to talk about the future of sales. Again, thank you for being here, and appreciate you helping fill the world with authentic persuaders.